Coming up on this episode, we're going off to the ballpark with Cat Sebastian. Hello, Rainbow Romance Reader. Welcome to episode 453 of the Big Gay Fiction Podcast, the show for avid readers and passionate fans of queer romance fiction. I'm Jeff, and it's great to have you here for another episode of the show. As always, the podcast is brought to you in part by our remarkable community on Patreon. Thanks to Jim for recently joining the community. If you'd like more information about what we offer to patrons, including the opportunity to ask questions to our guests, just like Mary does in this episode, go to patreon.com/biggayfictionpodcast. And don't forget, you can get book recommendations delivered to your inbox with the Rainbow Romance Reader Report. It's a look at books that are new and coming soon that we're excited about. Plus, we also have recommendations for you about what we're reading and watching. You can sign up for the Rainbow Romance Reader Report at biggayfictionpodcast.com/report. So as you already heard, Cat Sebastian is here, and we're going to talk about her latest, which is called You Should Be So Lucky, which is set in the same universe as last year's We Could Be So Good. And just a couple weeks ago, We Could Be So Good became a finalist for the 2024 Lambda Literary Awards in the gay romance category. There's some other great books up for this award, too, including The Secret Lives of Country Gentlemen by K.J. Charles, Dionysus in Wisconsin by E.H. Lupton, Mistletoe in Michigas by M.A. Wardell, and The Art of Husbandry by Jay Hogan. Congratulations to all of these finalists. The 36th Annual Lambda Literary Awards will be presented on June 11th, so we'll find out who wins that evening. And besides Kat, you can also hear from two other Lammy finalists who were previously on this show. We talked to M.A. Wardell back in episode 441, all about Mistletoe in Michigas. And if you want to go deeper into our archive, you can check out our interview with K.J. Charles back in episode 323. Now, let's talk for a moment about You Should Be So Lucky. I've been a Cat Sebastian fan since her first book, but this ranks among my favorites. As you'll hear Cat talk about in a moment, this story is about baseball player Eddie, who plays for New York, and is in the midst of a serious batting slump after having a great season the previous year. He also hated being traded to New York. It pulled him out of the environment that he was so comfortable in. And then there's Mark, who's a reporter, who usually covers the arts, but is now tasked with ghostwriting diary entries from Eddie to appear in the paper. He has no interest in doing this, but he's got very little choice. He's also still grieving his boyfriend who died a year ago. Suffice to say, these two are going through some crap times. But as they start hanging out together more, Eddie becomes more of a ray of sunshine, at least around Mark. And this is sunshine that Mark does his best to keep away from. But he can't. These two end up being such grumpy sunshine goodness. Watching their relationship grow as it does through the baseball season just touched me so much. And they've definitely become a favorite romance couple of mine. This story is also a great look at pre-Stonewall New York. And you get the feel of that desire for change, not only from Mark and Eddie, but from the people around them too, and just some of the vibe that's going on in the city. Now, as I mentioned a moment ago, Kat's among the finalists for a Lammy Award for the first book in the series, and I would not be surprised if she's a finalist again next year for You Should Be So Lucky. I really can't recommend this book enough. And you're going to hear more of what I loved about it in the interview too. So why don't we get to hear from Kat right now? I had a great time talking to her about why she decided to write about baseball, including the books that turned her on to baseball romance. We also hear about her inspiration for the characters of Mark and Eddie, and discuss what she enjoys writing about the 1960s. We also chat a little bit about the journalism of the time and dogs. Plus, Kat's got a couple of book recommendations too. Kat, welcome back to the podcast. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's springtime and we get to talk about some baseball, which is totally not my sport, but you kind of made me love it too, as we'll kind of get into as we talk about this book. I love You Should Be So Lucky so much. Tell everybody about this story and this romance that sparks between Eddie and Mark.
So the idea is that it's 1960 in New York, and this is the period in between when the Dodgers and the Giants have already left New York, but it's before the Mets have come. Okay, so, but in this universe, there's a new expansion team, and there's a player on the team named Eddie, and he is in his second year. Last year, he had a really promising rookie season, but now he's slumping really hard. And Mark is usually an arts writer, but he really hasn't been doing much of anything since his partner died the previous year. And he's assigned to basically ghostwrite some diary entries that Eddie's supposed to do for the paper. And like neither of them really wants to be doing this. Like Mark doesn't want to be covering baseball. Eddie doesn't want to be doing anything. And they're both going through like a garbage time, and they don't, you know, they don't like this is they don't want to be outside their comfort zone for very good reasons. And they wind up being like a bright spot in one another's lives.
I think bright spot's a little bit of an understatement, but talk more about that as we go through this.
Well, it's like I kept thinking, like, you know, how when you are like when you're going through it, like everything is bad, right? Like good weather is bad, good food is bad. You know what I mean? Like it's everything is already bad. And then so when you're doing something that you're expecting to be just as bad as everything else, and it turns out to be good, that's like a gift. It's like the universe decided to give you one. That's the book in a nutshell.
They certainly find each other in the moment that they probably needed it the most. What were kind of your inspirations for Eddie and Mark and the very oppositeness that they are to each other?
So I had been watching a lot of Ted Lasso. Okay.
That's good source material.
Yeah, right. And so I didn't, as I'm watching it, I'm not thinking to myself, like, I'm going to do anything with this. Okay. However, when my next idea was like a well-dressed and like kind of cranky and cynical sports reporter, I know that's because like I imprinted hard on Trent Crum. Okay. I know that. So it's not like that's my like fan casting for Mark in this book at all. Like physically they're not the same, but the energy is similar. And for Eddie, he's like every baseball player or athlete or whoever who has been given too much attention and is made to be like a role model, is idealized, and therefore doesn't have any space at all. So, I mean, the most obvious inspiration is Mickey Mantle, right? Because it's roughly the same era, you know. But other than that, there isn't really any specific player.
And why baseball? This is your very first sports book, and you dove in for baseball.
So, first of all, baseball is the only sport I really know anything about. And that's because I grew up in a household where there was always baseball on either the radio or the television for the whole season. Okay. And so I learned about it through osmosis, which is the same way that Mark knows about it in the book. Like he's not a baseball fan, but his father and then later on his partner were baseball fans. And so he knows about it secondhand. And so baseball is the only sport I know about. It's the only sport I have like any feelings about, although I've read 10 billion words of like hockey romance. So like I might need to revise that. Okay. But like when your only experience of a sport is like through romance novels, I'm not totally, you know what I mean? Like not the same as like baseball. I actually do know something about it as like a real life entity, you know? But then what happened was somebody recommended to me one of Katie Casey's books. Okay. And at that point I can't possibly read a baseball romance. The only sports romances I read are hockey romances because hockey is in my mind a fully make-believe sport. And like I read it and this book was like wonderful. This was their first book. It was Unwritten Rules. And I loved it. And then I binge read their second book. And then I started to complain about there not being any historical baseball romances. Okay. And there should be so many historical baseball romances because the only way we talk about baseball is like nostalgia. You know, like it's like the entire like baseball industrial complex is fueled by nostalgia. It always has been. All the baseball movies are nostalgic. Okay. People were nostalgic about baseball in the 50s. Okay. It's always been this way. There's always people who were nostalgic about baseball in the 1910s. There has always been this like we imagine that it's tied to like our feelings about what the country is. You know what I mean? There's just a lot going on. There's a lot of like cultural baggage in baseball. So there should be a whole shelf full of baseball romances, historical baseball romances. But actually, there really are very few historical sports romances. So, okay. Anyway, so I complained about it enough where I was like, clearly the solution is that I will have to write one. Okay. Which, by the way, is how, like, whenever I start complaining about a lack of something, I wind up writing it. And like, at this point, I should just like speed run through that whole process and just like, write the book instead of spending 6 months moaning about it to everybody. So what happened was I wrote a novella, just a little, like a little short little snack of a book about two baseball players, thinking I will get this out of my system. And that went exactly as well as it goes when a character in a romance novel thinks they're going to get something out of their system, which is not at all. And so like literally the minute I finished writing the novella, I started writing this book. And I think I started writing it before I even had the go ahead to do this book, like from my publisher and agent. I think I was just like that committed to a questionable idea. And it wound up being super fun to write. The first book in the series, We Could Be So Good, was a total delight to write. And this book was also a total delight, but in a different way. And now I never have to think about baseball again. It's like really the gift that I've given myself. You know, like it's...
Careful what you say. Some of these characters would come back and say, hey, Kat, what about me over here?
And it's because it is a sport I like to read about. I like to read nonfiction about it. I actually like to read sports writing about baseball a whole lot, but do I ever want to watch a game again? No, I actually don't want to. I'm good. I'm all set. So.
I love that Katie Casey was the inspiration because read those books and they were amazing. Although I didn't feel after I'd read those that I needed to go maybe try baseball again as I have in reading this one. There's something about the way that Mark's perception of the game changes as he's hanging out with the team and hanging out with Eddie. Is maybe this game isn't as boring as I think it is. Maybe there's something more there as they talk about like the statistics. And it's one of the only things where if you're batting less than half, that might be okay because half might be great. And all those numbers.
That is also like how people, sports writers, everybody has talked about baseball since basically its inception. Like that idea that there's like failures built into it. There was an article that came out like this week in Baseball Prospectus, I think, and a friend sent it to me. And the gist is baseball is a sport that reminds us that hard work doesn't necessarily get you there. And I was like, oh, we're still doing it. It's a century. We're still writing it. Like, I love it. I love it. And it's true. Like the idea that whenever we tell a story about baseball, it's a metaphor for something is absolutely correct, but it's also always a metaphor for the fact that hard work doesn't always get you anywhere, you know?
So you had some baseball in your head already. What was your research like for this? Because obviously the game has changed to some degree since 1960, but you're also very specifically digging in on how to fix a batting slump through a lot of this too.
And the good news is that you can't fix a batting slump, right? So like I got, and like that, so that was, that wound up being an easy thing for me to research is that it's like, unless there's a physical injury, it is like, it is purely throwing herbs on the floor. You know what I mean? Like, and trying to discern some kind of meaning. It is just like anything else. Like when something is going wrong, like you try to fix it, right? Even if it's like, I get migraines. Okay. I have been trying for 3 decades now to figure out what causes my migraines. I'm never going to know. Okay. Still, when I get more than 2 in a month, I go like full on superstition, you know, like where I'm analyzing patterns that simply do not exist. Right. So like, yeah, when something's going wrong, you're going to try all kinds of things to fix it. But like in this situation, there is simply no reason. Like there's a throwaway line in the book about a statistician, some professor who says that statistically slumps don't exist. And that idea hadn't come out by 1960. I think it's like a few years later, like that if one player is simply not hitting the ball and there's no injury, there's no reason for it, okay? That is the coin landing heads down 50 times in a row. Do you know what I mean? Like it's going to happen if you throw the coin enough. It has nothing to do with that player. It has nothing to do with the coin. It's just happening. It's just something that's happening. There's no meaning to it. And I enjoyed that. Like as I came across that bit of research, I was like, yes, that is the relationship to like bad things happening that I want this book to express. As far as actual research in baseball, it turns out that baseball in the early 60s has 10 gazillion words written about it. In particular, when the Mets came to New York that first year, every single writer waited on it. So we have some of the best sports writing ever is about that first year of the Mets. There's Roger Angel, there's Jimmy Breslin, there's people who were writing like Roger Angel is writing for the New Yorker. It's like really highbrow, really lyrical. Jimmy Breslin's writing for like the Daily News or the Post or something. And it's like this, and it's, you know, very down to earth. And so there's just an abundance of writing about that. And people are coming at it from all these different angles. Like, why are fans rooting for a terrible team? What does it mean to have a team in the city that's not the Yankees? All the ground is covered repeatedly and like beautifully. So that aspect of the research was a total joy. In terms of baseball then being different from it is now, it's also different now than it was when I was a kid and paying attention to it. Okay. Like in turn, like I was so baffled, like I was looking at the schedule of games. Like and there was something about it that wasn't making any sense to me whatsoever. And I realized it's because there's like all of this interleague play. And like, I couldn't make it compute in my mind. That's a thing that exists now and simply did not exist the last time I like seriously paid attention to baseball. And so that made it a little easier, right? Whereas I'm already like one step removed from like how things actually are. So I had to verify every single thing that I thought I knew about the game. Like I was already fact-checking all of my assumptions. So it turns out there was not a designated hitter, I don't think, like when the story takes place. But again, I checked that like 17 times because it all felt so weird to me.
And of course, as you noted, you've kind of come back to the newspaper that we got to know in We Could Be So Good. What is it about mid-century journalism that you have this, you're building your universe kind of there now, or one of your universes there?
So, okay. So like the like dark and sad reason is that like journalism as it existed in the middle of the 1900s is very much a historical artifact, right? You have like, even in small cities, there's like more than one thriving daily paper. You have newspapers in a city that has like many immigrant populations. You'll have cities and you'll have newspapers with different languages. Reporters have a union job that's not going to go anywhere. That era is starting to come to an end, like around when this book takes place, right? It's like we're a few years out from like, this big newspaper strike that kind of like really dealt a blow to the industry. But so I love that. Like I love like I feel nostalgic about like this, about like a universe where you have such a robust, that you have all of these newspapers and that journalism is like really strong and important. So there's that. And also, I think as a writer, writing about writers is always going to be a really easy thing to do. Okay. Like it is not just easy to research, but it's very easy for me to get into the mindset of somebody who writes words for a living.
Yeah, I can see that. And I just love the look at how, like, even though we're really looking at sports journalism here, there's the whole build across it, like how just journalism is not what it was. Even if you take out the unions and everything else, journalism is no longer what it was in the 60s. It's not even what it was when I went to college in journalism in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. Talk about something that changed drastically.
Yep. One of the things that like historical fiction does really well is addressing like when there is, you can sort of like wallow like in something that is lost. You know, like it is like, that is something that is lost to us for the foreseeable future. And like, you can sort of just roll around in it. And when you're in another time period.
Kind of the same thing with the queer history here too, in terms of you're almost a decade away from Stonewall. I mean, you're inside the decade, but you're certainly, mm-hmm. you know, at the earliest point in the decade that's from when Stonewall happens. But you could start to just feel the vibe in Mark and in Eddie that they want the change to happen. And one of them's a little more willing to kind of go for it than the other one is, at least in the beginning. But it's interesting to feel that vibe and to get the feel of the city itself in some ways that you kind of look at as Eddie kind of explores the village a little bit. And then because of the grief that Mark is going through and how, who knows about it, who doesn't, but who maybe has guessed what happened. It's a very interesting kind of look at that piece of history and how even in grief, you had to be very much closed off.
Yeah, I kept thinking about how it, like 1960 is like very much like we're at the beginning of being like on the cusp of something happening, right? And civil rights wise, Mark is I think 28 in this book, and he had been in a relationship where they had to be super duper closeted for many years, starting in, I think 1952. Okay, so Mark has been an adult for like the whole 50s, basically. And he saw the worst of it, right? Like the 50s are like about as bad, like we're just really, really, really a bad time. And so he is like rightfully traumatized by A, the fear of all of that he felt, but B, the experience of like being, of not having a relationship that he can talk about. So those two things are like interrelated, but they're not totally the same. He has like a lot that he needs to unpack and then about that. And Eddie is younger. He's 22. He is a generation who will still be young when Stonewall happens, right? And so he has a different sensibility. And also he's a trusting person. And you know what I mean? And that's, there are always going to be people. There are always going to be people who trust everyone around them. And whether or not they should just depends a lot about who is around them. And Eddie does. And he happens to have been lucky with the people who are on his team and the people he makes friends with and Mark. So he can say to himself, I'm going to like hope that everybody wants to keep a secret. And if it goes wrong, then it goes wrong and I will figure out the next chapter. And that's an attitude that it takes Mark a while to become comfortable with.
I'm actually not sure he'll ever be totally comfortable with it. Just because of what's ingrained, in him. Eddie certainly helps him kind of obviously move in that direction.
And there's a whole thing where it's, you're not comfortable, but you're going to do it anyway, right? Like the older I get, the more clear it is that that's just what you do, just in general, like being totally okay with something is like a rare event. And like it might, some people just don't have the personality to ever be okay with something. And I think that might be me, And so just pushing forward anyway is part of life.
It was interesting thinking about Eddie too, in that he came from somewhere where he felt more comfortable to be out. He doesn't so much say this in the book, but it really felt, ripping him away when the trade happened and bringing him to New York. And I mean, today we think of New York as like this vastly liberal place. And yet he felt almost, he had to reset everything and what his expectations could be here because it had been so good where he was. And it's, I would have never, these days, and even in the 70s and 80s, people are like, I'm going to New York because it's better there. But the 60s read differently, at least here.
Yeah. I mean, like his main problem is that if he's in New York, that's a huge media market and he is going to be afraid of being recognized, right? But if he knew how to find like the queer community when he was playing in Kansas City or when he was growing up in Omaha, like these were much smaller cities. He knew where to go. There was much less of a chance of him being outed, basically, or at least in his calculus, right? Like in his mind, he was safer then than when he moved to New York, where he feels like he's constantly being watched. And one of the reasons he feels like he's constantly being watched is because there are like seven newspapers at the time in New York, and they're all covering his team, and they're all saying bad things about him. And so he feels justifiably paranoid, right? So for him, it feels like moving to New York is a very scary and dangerous thing. And also he's moving away from, he grew up in like a loving family, which is not something all romance novel characters get. He loves his mom, and like now we can't see her as often. This is all like in his, like, this is all really bad for him.
One of many differences that sit there between Mark and Eddie. Eddie is so, in some ways cavalier, but in some ways like, I'm just going to do this thing because it's what I feel compelled to do. And Mark wants to do the thing, as he puts it, he doesn't want to be a secret, but yet he's scared about going forward. How did you manifest these characters? I mean, did they just kind of spring this way? Because that happens where it's just like fully formed, or, you know, was there a lot of tinkering as you went through? It's almost like a masterclass in bringing opposites together.
Well, thank you. Yeah, there was tinkering, like big time. This was a book where like I knew the general trajectory, like I knew what was going to happen in terms of they were going to do this and then they were going to do this. But what they were going to be feeling while they were doing it took a little bit of fixing it on revision. Like basically it's, yeah, they're opposites, but from almost the beginning, they like one another, you know? And so they view one another through, for the most part, through the most favorable lens. And it's about having that kind of how when you like someone for reasons that you may not even know, right? Not necessarily even attraction, where you're just like vibing, you know, where you are prepared to be really generous in your dealings with them. And so when I say it like that, it is like the least romantic thing I've ever said in my life. But that is the process of two people falling in love, you know, like is that they decide to think the best of one another.
There's a book in and of itself there somewhere for romance authors. There's a passage in there too, where I think it's Eddie thinking about Mark and how, you know, Mark gets really prickly when he wants something. But if Eddie needs something, then he's 100% like, we got to do this. We got to make that happen. And I like how you even capture that piece of it, because that's such a thing, becoming a couple. It's like just how you react to the various things that just each other do and being able to read that. And it was just one of those things that's like, oh, it just kind of warmed my heart that they kind of had that thinking about each other.
Mark is like a very prickly character. You know, he doesn't think of himself as a nice person. He's whatever. He is not entirely correct, right? But he is not a very nice person. He doesn't like a lot of people. He doesn't have the time or the patience to deal with most people. He is an introvert. And he is kind of bitchy, I think, because he would be okay with that terminology, okay? And yet, we all know people who are like fully caustic. And yet when it's someone they like, they turn it around, you know, 180 degrees. And I think that's that like urge, when you see yourself as being like a difficult person, like when all of a sudden you're seized by the urge to be good to somebody else, right? Or that is itself, like not just for the person like receiving that goodness, but for you when it happens to you, that is a lot. You know, because it's like that comes out of the blue. And so that is something that Mark experiences.
Yeah, it's all part of his wonderful growth through the book. You've got amazing support characters in this story. You mentioned Eddie's mom a little bit, who is, their relationship could be a book on its own. I don't know what it would be exactly, but just watching their interactions, it'd be pretty amazing. There's Artolino, who's the team manager, who's got his own kind of arc alongside the team. Mark's friends Lillian and Maureen are right there to kind of nudge him in the right direction a little bit, but also a good outlet for him with everything else. And then Lulu the dog. Lula has very strong opinions of her own.
Lula is based on a rat terrier who I used to have.
Aww.
Yeah. If you go on, most of my social media profile pictures are me holding that dog. And he died in 2020 at the age of 17, at which point he was held together by nothing but like venom and like bad attitude. He is like Lula's future self. I was home with this dog like for years. And if I did something wrong, this dog would find an object of mine and like pee on it. Okay. Like once there was nothing bad enough for him to do, so he figured out how to jump onto the kitchen counter and like pee on my coffee pot. Okay. Wow. This dog was genuinely a bad dog. Okay. And I have never loved another, I've never loved an animal like that. And so I wanted to write about that experience of loving an animal who gives you nothing. And because this was Mark's partner's dog, right? This was never Mark's dog. And Lula knows it, right? Like all Lula knows is that her person is gone. And instead, you know, like she's left with this inferior person, right? And yeah, when Mark goes away on a trip, Mark comes back and like all of a sudden Lula decides to be affectionate, okay? Because Lula's like, now she's, oh no, they could all go. And so she decides to be affectionate to Mark, which of course Mark loves. But yeah, I think that like often in fiction, dogs are like, you know, they have like dog energy, right? They're like good and affectionate. And I wanted to write about a little nightmare who had nothing but spite to give.
Lula softens too, because Eddie's exactly what she needed.
Yes. And also she's going to be nice to Eddie, because my old dog used to do this thing where like anyone who came over to the house, the dog would put on this like sad little orphan Annie act. Like, I've never been loved. I've never been fed. No one's ever pet me, you know, and every single person who came over to the house. And so that's what's happening with Eddie, is this is, you know, I'm going to show you what affection looks like by doing it not to you. And I enjoyed writing Lula. I highly recommend it. If you have lost a dog, putting it in the book is like a very good experience. But yeah, since this book is like two characters who are having a hard time, surrounding them with people who are like, or dogs who are like overall like net positive, is, it makes the reading experience and the writing experience better, right? Because it's a character who has a bad thing in the context of a life full of good things, right?
And the trajectory of some of these characters, because I'm not going to go into spoilers, also evolves so amazingly over the book that people are like, I don't know if I like you. It's like, oh, now I see. Back to net good, you know, because of what goes on.
Since it's a book, like, it's not a second chance romance, obviously, but it's a book about second chances, right? Everybody in the book, basically everybody gets a second chance. And so there's like a lot of characters who are turning it around in various ways, right? Who are trying to make changes, who are trying to be better, or who like a lot of the baseball players are in the book would have retired if they weren't on this team. Like, they are too old to be playing baseball, which is how they got picked for the expansion draft, basically. And so the reason they're on the team is because this is another year of them being able to do the job they love. They get a second chance. You know, the team itself is a second chance for New York to have another team. There's an elderly sports reporter who, he didn't want to retire with a desk job, basically. He wanted to travel with the team and be a beat reporter. And so he gets his second chance to do that.
I love George. Yeah, so I forgot to put George in that list of characters, but George is wonderful.
He's like a very old school sports reporter. He's, I think, almost 80 in the book. And he winds up being like Mark, who had the horrendous family of origin. And at no point does Mark ever think to himself, like, I'm looking for a father figure or anything like that, right? He wouldn't let himself have that thought. He winds up like having a relationship with George that is like paternal. Like, he really like appreciates George's like acceptance, I guess. Like, it means something to him because he didn't have that and he didn't even know he wanted it. And now he has it, and that's a good thing.
I know it's hard to pick from your darlings, but other than Lula, who we've already talked about, was there a favorite character amongst all these side characters who were like your favorite to get to have a moment with?
Every scene I wrote with George, I loved. I feel like we've all known a George, you know, and like some of us have had like grandparents who were George. Yeah. And I really enjoyed that.
And speaking of favorites, what's a favorite scene from the book?
I think my favorite scene is one that came as an afterthought. My editor said, you know, there's not enough Nick in this book. Nick isn't in your book. You know, Nick is one of the main characters from the first book in this series. Okay. We could be so good. And I was like, that is a major problem. Like, that's absolutely right. Like, I often don't like to go back to previous characters because, first of all, I feel like I'm guaranteed to make a continuity error. And secondly, they're done. Like, they're happy. We don't need to look at them. But that's like me as a writer, as a reader, I love that. And so my editor was absolutely right. Like, Nick needed to be in this book and he's in the book. Nick needed to be appearing on the page, not just as a name who's referenced. And so there's a scene where towards the end of the book where Nick and Mark, who know one another because they both work at the same paper, go out to a sports bar where Mark is basically he wants Nick to tell him that he needs to break up with Eddie, basically. Nick's the guy, he'll do it. You know, like, he's cynical. And instead, Nick is like very much still Nick, and he is still very cynical, and like being cynical and like pretty negative manages to discombobulate Mark pretty thoroughly, like about what his expectations ought to be, like in a relationship. So I really like that. Like once I knew that scene had to exist, it was like a blast to write, and it was great revisiting Nick as a person and like also knowing absolutely that is what Nick would say and that is what Nick would do.
I love that you picked that because it's one of the ultimate moments that Mark didn't get told what he wanted to hear, because he kept looking for that person to be the one to tell him, don't do this. And nobody was having that.
No, and ultimately Mark, I mean, it's the first draft of the book had, often my first draft of books has like your traditional third act breakup. I don't usually have that like in the finished book, like at least, not lately at least, but often that's, as I'm drafting, that winds up being sort of like an easy way to say like, what would be the issue that took these guys apart, right? What would that look like? And then at that point, I know it's wrong. And for me, right? Or like for this situation. And then I can go back and get those same exact issues on the page, like without the breakup. And in this instance, that scene with Nick like serves the goal. That's, it makes Mark think. It makes Mark make at least one stupid choice, right? But it's not a breakup choice. It's just being dumb. Yeah, I enjoyed that a lot.
I like watching him have to think a lot, which he does, because he's challenged so much in this book. I mean, they both have their challenges, but the way that Mark is challenged, I particularly enjoyed it.
He really just wants to be in his comfort zone, and his comfort zone is mean and sad, and it is the size of a postage stamp, right? And the fact that he is being like pushed out of his like sad little comfort zone is, he is bothered by it from beginning to end, right? And that's relatable. You know, it's very fun to take a character who is not like stuck, but like deliberately stuck, like heels dug in, you know, I'm fine like this, what are you talking about, you know, and sort of drag them not far, but just like 3 inches to the side, you know, and be like, nope, you can have nice things, like the thing you're fighting against is just nice things, that's it, so you need to calm down. And like to make that happen is, I feel like when I read it in a book, it always looks so easy because the only change is in their mind. It's not an external conflict. It's purely internal. And so, you know, one of the like truisms about writing is that you shouldn't ever have the conflict be something that can just change with a conversation or like changing your mind. Okay. But like in reality, changing your entire mindset isn't just something you can just change. Okay. I feel like we all have things where like we know that even if we know something is a fact, believing it is different. And I don't, there are all kinds of facts that I know, and yet I tell myself the opposite all day long, you know? And it's absolutely not a helpful thought process, but we all have them anyway. But so when you're reading it, it often looks super easy, but writing it and making it look like it isn't something that where they could have changed on page five, like where they could have just made this decision on page five, like that is like sleight of hand. And I do that too. I like kind of feeling like, oh, I pulled it off, you know?
Yeah, I like it when that third act breakup is not a cataclysm. It's a little something. And in the, you know, this conversation with Nick is, you know, one of those kind of things, forcing him to think, come into the light.
That's a good point. When we talk about third act breakups, we're often talking about what you just said, a cataclysm, where it's like everyone's crying, you know, like it's over, like it's very final. We've laid the relationship to rest. You know, like maybe we have a time jump forward of a year or whatever, you know, like where it's like totally like it is done. We've moved on. Or it can just be like, we don't talk for a week, right? Or like things are weird. It can be, you know, it can be like that there's some unresolved issue and everyone is going to dance around it and just be weird about it. Or it can be one big fight that gets resolved immediately, but still leaves everybody feeling kind of traumatized. Like these are all like different ways that you can handle that type of thing and also dispatch it like in that same moment, you know, where like you can even at the beginning have the characters know that it's going to be over, but this isn't permanent, right? It still provides some kind of narrative tension that gets the reader to actually turn the page rather than be like, oh, it's 80%, and I guess I'm done now, you know?
Exactly.
I've written my share of like literal third act breakups, cataclysms for sure. And I don't really do it anymore just because like I'm the boss of me, et cetera. I can do what I want to do. It is so much less stressful for me as a writer to write the kind of story where it is, where nothing terrible happens at that 80% mark or at that 70% mark, right? I have found that like when I'm writing something that's really stressful, I get stressed. I am like internalizing the stress of this stuff that I made up. Okay. Like these characters, I made them up in my head and now I'm stressed about it. I wish I could figure out like what breathing exercises I could do to not have that happen. You know, like I get stressed about real things and now I'm going to go borrow trouble with this stuff. I made them up. And so if I can just write a story where that doesn't happen, my job becomes like 500% better because mm-hmm. I don't have that hanging over me. And that seems to appeal to not all readers. Some readers are absolutely going to want, are going to want bigger drama, you know, totally valid, but it appeals to enough readers that I have a job, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't mind having my heart stomped on mm-hmm. periodically, but I'm also really happy to read something very low angst and there's going to be tension, but it's not going to be the cataclysm either.
Yeah. I mean, as a reader, like, absolutely. I want my heart stomped on sometimes. And also I want low angst sometimes. I want like a varied diet as a mm-hmm. reader, you know?
So we've got a question from a member of our Patreon community. And Mary asks, why the move from what is traditionally considered historical romance? Because she says, as an elder romance reader, and the fact that she lived through the 60s makes me a bit more gray-haired when my childhood is considered historical.
I totally feel this because like by my standard of what makes a historical romance, like the 90s count. Okay. And like, I was fully an adult for half that decade, right? My like definition of like when something counts as a historical is basically if it is before the memory of your average reader, not most readers, but like your average reader. Okay. And so if we take the average reader as 35, which is like a big if, okay, but I still feel like that's probably borne out. Then the 90s are like before they remember. They're babies. And so I feel like that's historical. It's also like tangibly a different era because you have enough differences in technology that it's like, you can see it immediately on the page that it's a different period. Okay. So yes. And also I have read 90s historical romance that made me feel 5,000 years old. Okay. Especially when it's written by somebody who's definitely younger than me. Okay. Where I feel like that, like that's the thing is if it's written by someone who wasn't there and they're like, they had to Google this. They had to Google this.
They had to research it.
Yes. So Mary, I absolutely feel this. I am sorry that I did that to you. What happened was like, I had written 13, 14 books that took place like in your like standard horse and cravat era of romance. And I just needed to do something different. That's like, you know, that's really what it came down to. Like I have, you know how some writers can write 50 books that are set in the same little town? Like a lot of cozy mystery writers can do this. And that is like a skill. I don't have it. What happens to me is that if I feel like I hit a rut, I need to do like a hard turn in another direction. And that's what happened, where I had written a certain number of reaches and I started to feel like I was going to be recycling plot elements and characters. I don't even know if that's true, but that's what it felt like. A friend was putting together an anthology and I said, I'm going to write a 1950s novella for this. And it was a blast. And then people liked it. And so I wrote another one. And this is all self-published. It was so much fun. It felt like a breath of fresh air. And so when I had written on my last Regency, I just sat down and wrote We Could Be So Good. I knew that I wanted to write something in the 60s. I had no idea if my publisher would buy it. Not a clue. I wrote the book and then basically acted like I had tripped and fallen and come up with a full, like a complete manuscript. And so now I've written like two trad published books that are set in roughly the same era. And it's really fun. I like the era. I think that we have a lot of media set in like the middle of the last century. There's a lot of television, a lot of movies. The aesthetics are perfect. Not a lot of romance novels. And so I kind of just wanted to, because there wasn't a lot. but also because the 50s and the early 60s are like just a terrible and dangerous time for a lot of marginalized groups, including queer people, obviously. I think that we are living through an era where the rights of a lot of groups are being curtailed again. And I just wanted to write something about individuals and also community, like thriving despite the danger of persecution, where that act of being happy, that act of thriving is itself kind of like a rebellion.
Is there a historical period, regardless of like Regency up through, you know, wherever we want to leave the mark, which might be the 90s, kind of based on what you mentioned, is there a period you want to write about that you haven't quite tackled yet?
So I was thinking about this because I'm right now trying to pitch my next book, right? Like this is, and the market for historical romance is just extremely weak at the moment. And so it's like very, like this, the stakes feel extremely high. I think I've covered most of the 20th century that I'd want to. The 20s and 30s don't interest me as much as a writer as they do as a reader and a movie watcher, you know? But I have been toying with the idea of a Gangs of New York era, like 1850s style, like just really low lives type of setting. But again, that's now we're back to horses and cravats, you know, and trains and crime. So I don't know. I actually have no idea. There is no easy answer. I don't think I've ever been in this position before, actually, of not really knowing what comes next. I like have a book on submission, but whether that actually goes anywhere is a different story, right? That doesn't necessarily mean anything. And so we'll see. Like I have my fingers crossed. We'll see.
We've got to get recommendations, of course.
Okay.
What are you reading or watching or both that our listeners should be checking out?
Just finished Emma Albin's Don't Want You Like a Best Friend. It is a parent trap retelling set in Victorian England. And it is so funny. And it's the kind of historical that has chosen not to, you're never at any point in this book about to forget that it was written in 2024, right? Like it's that kind of book. It is, and it works. Like many things, if an author delivers something with confidence, it just works. And that's what happens here. So like you would not at any point be surprised if the characters were like vibe check, okay? Like or like, you know, something like that. You'd just be like, yes, this is all completely accurate. It's a delight. It is one of the most fun books I read in a while. And the fact that it's a parent trap retelling, and the fact that I don't think there are any other parent trap retellings, you know, is also super fun. Obviously, they're not sisters in the book. They're like friends and their parents were involved at some point. And they're like scheming to get their parents back together, but then they fall in love. It's just very cute. Nice. I love that. And I recently read Lucky Bounce by Kate Nary, which came out like a month ago, I think, 2 months ago. And I had an early copy of it, which I read like last year, and then I reread it after it came out, and it was like even better than I remember it being. Like such a fun book, like just a romp, you know, and just like light and airy and fun. So those two books are like, those are terrific.
Nice. Awesome. And what is the best way to keep up with you to know when you know what's coming, but all the fun stuff about you?
So my website and my newsletter are the best right now. I am on Instagram, but like I'm attempting to not be anywhere else. Okay. And like, honestly, when I'm on Instagram, I'm watching people make pottery. Okay. I'm like, nice. You know, like my inbox is pretty full. I'm like, it's an embarrassment. My website is catsebastian.com. And there is a link there to sign up for my newsletter, which I send out maximum once a month. At least once a year I send out free stories, so you know, in exchange for me arriving in your inbox approximately 11 times per year.
We will link up to that plus everything we talked about in our show notes. Wish you all of the success with You Should Be So Lucky, because it's just amazing.
Thank you.
This episode's transcript has been brought to you by our community on Patreon. If you'd like to read the conversation for yourself, head on over to the show notes page for this episode at biggayfictionpodcast.com. We've also got links to everything that we've talked about in this episode. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did, and that you're going to pick up You Should Be So Lucky. What better time to read it than right now while we're in baseball season? All right, I think that's going to do it for now. Coming up on Monday, May 20th, we're going to find out everything there is to know about the Rainbow Readers Cruise from its organizers, Joel Leslie, Joyfully Jay, and Rich Natchik. I want to thank you so much for listening, and I hope that you'll join us back here again soon for more discussions about the kinds of stories we all love, the big gay fiction kind. Until then, keep turning those pages and keep reading.
Big Gay Fiction Podcast is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more shows you'll love at frolic.media/podcasts. Original theme music by Daryl Banner.